The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Nick Watt, and welcome to Politics Weekly.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favourite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
Yes, we all thought Margaret Thatcher had put U-turns out of business nearly 30 years ago. But Gordon Brown has revived this great British tradition by coughing up the best part of £3 billion to repair the damage after the abolition of the 10p starting tax rate. Downing Street hoped the announcement would clear the air ahead of what was meant to be the biggest event of the week, the Prime Minister's announcement of his next legislative programme. But David Cameron was scathing, detecting a £3 billion giveaway to ensure Labour doesn't lose next week's by-election in Crewe and Nantwich.
I've got a better idea for the Prime Minister. Why not take part in a reality show that involves the whole of the country? It's called a general election. And wouldn't it give everyone the chance to stand up in front of the Prime Minister and say, you're fired?
We'll be asking where the U-turn leaves the Prime Minister and whether that draft Queen's speech will help him recover. As you know, we're highbrow souls here at Politics Weekly, so we'll also be taking a look at the soap opera of the Westminster Village by discussing the series of memoirs published this week by Cherie Blair, John Prescott and Lord Levy. Joining me to discuss these matters are Jenny Russell, the Guardian columnist. Jenny, you're still in mourning over the departure of Tony Blair.
I think almost everyone in the country has begun to think he had some points, even though we didn't want him to stay.
We have Martin Kettle, the Guardian columnist. Martin is one of the Guardian's greatest fans of Gordon Brown.
I certainly am. Bring him on.
And finally, we are joined for the first time on Politics Weekly by Lance Price, the former BBC journalist who served as one of Tony Blair's spin doctors. Lance joins us from his bolt hole in France. Salut, Lance.
Salut. Comment ça va?
Très bien, merci. Well, we asked Simon Hoggett, the Guardian's parliamentary sketch writer, to describe the scenes when one of Britain's national treasures turned up in the Commons.
Just come away from Prime Minister's Question Time and the Queen's speech, which is now actually delivered by Gordon Brown. Rather odd, really, but the Queen will get a chance to deliver a later version of it. The big excitement at the Commons was not the Queen's speech at all, but the fact that Bruce Forsyth, the popular entertainer, was sitting there with his lovely Latin American wife in one of the jury boxes, they're called, one of the low benches, sort of first-class seat to watch the debate. And, of course, everybody was very excited by that indeed. David Cameron was launching a ferocious assault on Gordon Brown and his plans for the coming legislative session.
Isn't a big part of the disastrous premiership his failure to be straight with people? Isn't that what we're seeing? A Prime Minister putting short-term decisions in front of the national interest.
Yeah! It is the right honourable gentleman that is playing politics.
He was particularly scathing about a plan that's been leaked in which there would be a kind of version of The Apprentice, but with the government, with Gordon Brown or other politicians testing people to see if they'd be any good in government. David Cameron really scoffed at that. He said it's The Apprentice meets Maria meets Strictly Come Dancing, which of course got a huge laugh from Mr. Forsyth as he sat there. What he then said, David Cameron, was that we needed a reality show in which the whole nation could join in. It's called an election, and every voter would have a chance to say to the Prime Minister, you're fired.
Isn't that the only way we're going to get a government that really gives people control over their lives?
Of course, Gordon Brown merely said that was another example of a salesman without substance. And it was, as usual, a very aggressive, embittered Prime Minister's Question Time that preceded the whole thing. David Cameron insisted that the back down on the 10p tax had been produced out of a hat just in time for the Crewe by-election next week. Gordon Brown insisted that it had to be done now in order to rewrite the budget. David Cameron said that he was never, ever straight with the public, but he basically twisted and turned every way that he could and every time that he could. If it's supposed to be the big fight back for the Prime Minister, it was a start. It could have gone worse. It wasn't brilliant. But at least things, for once, don't look worse today than they did the day before.
Martin, obviously I was joking when I introduced you because you've written a few pieces saying that if the Labour Party had any sense, they might think about ditching Gordon Brown. Tell me, has he avoided a disaster with that 10p U-turn and the draft Queen's speech?
Well, I think he's done the one thing that he definitely had to do, which is to make a big, clear decision and send a big, clear message to Labour's remaining supporters and to Labour MPs about an issue which I think would otherwise utterly haunt his premiership and may continue to do so. We don't know. But, I mean, it had to be done. He didn't want to do it. He didn't even want to do it in this way. That kind of across-the-board increase in personal allowances is not a Gordon Brown type of measure, but it sends a very clear message, at least that's the intention. And, of course, it's got one eye on the next week's by-election, as well as the generally tumultuous and very unhappy mood amongst Labour MPs at Westminster.
Lance, Martin saying that Gordon Brown needed to and indeed did send a big, clear message. Do you think he's done that? Has he recovered?
Well, he has done that on this one particular issue. I mean, he said very, very clearly to everyone who's been complaining about the effects of the abolition of the 10p tax rate that he has got the message. But it's only part of what he has to do. And I think he has to do something much more dramatic than that in order to get people to look at him afresh, because even having done this, he may have dealt with the immediate problems of the abolition of the 10p tax rate, although some people are still saying that they'll be worse off. But at the cost of people wondering, really, you know, this was a very, very expensive way to get yourself out of a problem of your own making. And in the longer term, of course, the questions about his economic competence and whether or not in difficult economic times, it's better to stick with somebody who in the past we've always thought of as being very good at managing the economy, whether that argument still stands.
Jenny, that's interesting. Lance used an interesting phrase there, saying Gordon Brown needed to show that he got the message. Has he got the message?
I think the problem is that the measures this week show that the message he's got is that he's got to do anything required in order to ensure his own political survival. But what the country understands very clearly is that he didn't make this change on principle. He made this change because of political expediency. And so, unfortunately, what he's lost and what he still has not regained, it's hard to see how he can regain it, is a sense of being a man who you can trust because, above all else, he's got the interests of the poor at heart. And I think the big message from the way the Labour Party has tried to deal with the 10 pence tax row is that, actually, they're in a muddle. It would have been much better just to restore the 10 pence tax rate band and then start withdrawing it steadily for people who earn more than, say, £18,000 a year. Instead of which, what he's ended up doing is giving a ridiculously large tax cut to people who earn up to £40,000 who don't need it, and you're still leaving a million of the poorest earners losing out.
Martin, that's an interesting point from Jenny there. Do you think we're in one of those situations where the Prime Minister had a difficulty, he dealt with it, but was it too late, and has he lost his authority, and will he ever recover it?
Well, I mean, his authority has been in decline ever since he decided not to call a general election last autumn. He did think he had dealt with the abolition of the 10p tax rate earlier on this spring by promising that it would all get sorted out in the autumn statement, the pre-budget report. But once it became clear to backbenchers that this wasn't yet sorted out in a way that reassured voters on the doorstep, and once Labour had got an absolute hammering in the local elections, they had to make a second move, which is what has now happened. I think the great lesson of this whole event is not so much about Gordon Brown himself, but it's about Labour misgovernment. And I think now there is a great job of reassurance and rebuilding that has to be done, and which may well not be possible in the time available, to prove that basically Labour knows what it is doing, has goals, knows how to achieve them, because this whole episode has completely confused its the party, its supporters and its voters, and their confidence, I think, is clearly at rock bottom. And we'll just have to see next week in Crewe, and then over the coming weeks, whether Brown, by a series of measures that he's taking this week, is beginning to rebuild something. But it's far too early to say that that's happened.
Lance, Martin there is saying that there's sort of a deeper problem with Labour misgovernment. Do you think there's a deeper problem with Labour, a deeper problem with the new Labour project, or do you, as a former loyal servant to Tony Blair, think that there's a character problem with the man famously described by your former boss, Alistair Campbell, as psychologically flawed?
Now, Nick, we don't know whether Alistair Campbell said that, and he swore blind that he hadn't. And, of course, we always take what Alistair says at face value. So
absolutely.
We should put that to one side immediately and correct that.
I take that taking off very seriously.
On my former boss.
Of course.
Actually, I don't think it's a question of Labour misgovernment. I mean, I don't think this government is actually bad in terms of its overall management of the, including the economy and of the country. That's not their problem. I think Gordon Brown's much bigger problem is that people have just lost any sense of what he's in politics for. I mean, I think I understand what he's in politics for, but he's very, very bad at communicating it. And the kind of signals that we've been receiving over the last few days and weeks simply muddy the water more. Tony Blair, for all his faults, had a great skill of providing what we used to call a narrative about the government. I mean, you could sort of understand the story. You could understand that he was in favour of wealth generation. He didn't want to smash the rich. He wanted to ensure that people earned good money, so they paid high taxes so that that money could be used to help the less well-off. He wanted to bring people into work so that they were paying taxes rather than receiving benefits, all that sort of stuff. But he was able to spin it together. I use the word spin in the nicest possible way. He was able to spin it together into a narrative and a story that made sense to people. And at the moment, we're getting all these conflicting signals from Gordon Brown, and no one's quite sure what the narrative's supposed to be. No one's really sure what he's about. And I think he needs, actually, a Hillary Clinton moment. He needs one of those moments where, not literally, but the tears come into his eyes, and he says, look, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm in politics for a good reason, for very serious reasons, and here's what they are.
An entirely natural and spontaneous moment. Jenny, you're laughing.
I'm laughing because, Lance, if you know now what Gordon Brown is in politics for, could you please just tell us in a sentence?
Well, in a sentence is difficult, but, I mean, he is genuinely, genuinely in politics because he believes in public service and doing everything possible to use the powers of government in order to help those least well off. I mean, he really is an old-fashioned Labour Prime Minister, but he's afraid to say so because he understands that you can't go back and be another Harold Wilson. I'm not saying Harold Wilson was a great Prime Minister, but you can't go back and be a traditional Labour Prime Minister and expect to win these days. He thinks that you've still got to dress it all up in the new Labour language, but he's much less convincing at doing it than Tony Blair was.
Martin.
Well, I mean, you talk about Hillary Clinton moments. I mean, his problem is not just that he might have to have a tear in the eye moment, but he might have to have the kind of moment Hillary Clinton's going to have fairly soon, which is to recognise that the game's up.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I'm not saying that having a Hillary Clinton moment is going to change things, and it may well be that at the end of the day, the Tory position now is pretty well unstoppable as they go towards the next general election, but it's still 2 years away. But in a sense, you know, we are in the British equivalent of a primary campaign where we've got these two leaders out there trying to convince people of their various merits. Neither of them have been elected before. Gordon Brown is Prime Minister without ever having been elected to the post, in a sense, he is the Hillary Clinton to Cameron's Barack Obama, who's got all the slickness and all the razzmatazz and the glib ways.
If that's the case, Lance, do you think it would be wise for the Labour Party to skip a generation and go for David Miliband or Alan Johnson or James Purnell sort of now?
Well, I think it's probably too late for that. I mean, I did argue in The Guardian and elsewhere that an election for leader would have been good, not only for the party, but also for Gordon Brown. And I think part of Gordon Brown's problem is that he didn't fight an election, and therefore not a single Labour MP, not a single member of the Labour Party voted for Gordon Brown as leader of the party. Had he fought an election, I think probably he would have won it. And when I was arguing for an election, it wasn't just because I liked the idea of having somebody else to vote for. But I don't think there's an appetite out there now. I just think it's too late. I can't see the circumstances that would lead to him stepping aside because he's not that sort of person, or indeed a push of some kind to get rid of him. Would the Labour Party be in a better position if we were being led by somebody of a newer generation? I think probably yes, we would.
Jenny.
Well, I was also one of those who argued a year ago that Brown should face an internal election because I thought that was his opportunity to set out what he believed in and for him to test his arguments and his principles. And I thought then that it was problematic if he didn't, because how is he going to effectively fight a campaign against the Conservatives if he'd never had this experience? And I think what Lance says is right, but in a sense it's even worse than that. It's true that Labour MPs didn't vote for Brown, but enormous numbers of them nominated him, and they began to do so like lemmings once it became clear that Brown was going to get power and that there wasn't really any tide within the party of opinion that said there ought to be an election. And frankly, they did that out of fear. People didn't want to be seen to be on the losing side because Brown has such a reputation for retaliating against people who aren't part of his group. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that now. And it's not just Brown's fault that everything's going wrong in the party. It is also the fault of the party. They have been frightened of him and they have acted like sheep. And they've trusted that he knows what he's doing. And now that things are going badly, there is panic in the ranks. And I think it was excellent that the parties started rebelling over 10-pence tax. But it also reflected the fact that they had no other way of getting their unhappiness across to this prime minister. And so he's suffering from the fact that essentially he's been fantastically politically isolated and he hasn't had the input from other people in the party.
Great, thanks for that. Well, David Cameron has a spring in his step, as he made clear to the world when he said the Prime Minister had nicked most of his ideas for that draft Queen's speech.
Mr. Speaker, there are lots and lots of things in this statement that we welcome, not least because we propose them. We welcome the constitution for the NHS. That's an idea we set out last June. We welcome the extension of the right to flexible working. We announced that in September 2006. We welcome the independent exam regulator. I raised that and proposed it in 2005. The list is enormous. A simple savings scheme, 2005 Tory manifesto. Regulatory budgets, 2006, I think. The list is almost as long as the draft Queen's speech. So I hope when the Prime Minister gets up, we'll get a bit of gratitude from the Prime Minister for all of this. Can't really say we haven't got any substance when he's taken it all and put it in his Queen's speech.
Martin, Lance was saying that there may well be now an unstoppable momentum towards a Conservative government. This therefore creates a key moment for David Cameron, doesn't it? Because people are now looking at him as a potential and real Prime Minister.
Absolutely. I mean, the polls are very clear. The lead is very long. He's now going to be judged by the highest standards. That means he's got to win everything he's expected to win, and he's got to play every crisis in a way which cements and supports that momentum. I think that will obviously create a lot of important challenges for him, and sooner or later the Tories are going to have to move onto the front foot and start telling people what kind of a Britain they intend to govern over after the next general election. And I think Cameron will have to find another mode, as well as his attack mode against Brown. He's, you know, been very effective. But as Simon Hoggett was saying, it was quite a sort of bad-tempered exchange this week, and it is generally at the moment Cameron's very contemptuous of Brown. He doesn't want to just keep on being in that mode. Otherwise, I think he, will begin to diminish himself a bit. So he's got to be quite careful. Obviously, at the moment, while things are going exceptionally well for him, he can afford simply just to keep making sure that his opponent is on the floor and he just stays there.
Lance, Martin is saying that David Cameron needs to be perhaps a little less angry, do a bit more than attack mode. Do you see a new Tony Blair in the making?
Well, it's interesting the comparison with Tony Blair, because David Cameron has taken so much of his strategy in opposition from the New Labour war book in opposition, the way in which Tony Blair got himself elected in the first place. But what's missing from it so far is some of those actually rather thoughtful speeches that Tony Blair used to make on issues like crime and education and so on and so forth, that showed that he was doing a lot of fresh thinking. And it's not really enough for David Cameron to say, oh, well, you know, we've got these policies and they must be good ones because you've nicked them. He too has to provide the narrative that I was talking about before. And I think that's still absent. We need to see a bit more of a thoughtful David Cameron and a David Cameron who is prepared to say to the people, it's not going to be easy governing this country, and I'm not going to pretend that it is. And again, Tony Blair was quite good at that, at lowering expectations in a funny sort of way of a Labour government. And by lowering expectations about what could necessarily be achieved quickly because of the seriousness of the problems, raising his own stature as somebody who could be taken seriously.
Martin.
Yeah, just one quick point on what you just said, Lance. I mean, I've been to two or three quite small-scale events which Cameron has spoken at recently on the theme of the post-bureaucratic society, which does seem to be something which the Tories are market testing as a narrative, if you like, for what a Cameron government might look like. I've found those quite interesting, and there was quite a lot of meat and substance in those. I'm not saying that it'll work in the public arena, but it was. I think there is something going on there that we need to be aware of.
But he does have to bring it forward into the public arena, because at the moment he just seems a little bit cheesy to some people, I think, and a little bit too slick and a bit too clever, and all of that's working very, very well on the sort of superficial level, and he's scoring points politically in a superb sort of a way. But if there is more substance there, and I'm sure there is, I mean, we've got to see it brought forward, brought to the forefront of his performance, so that people start to take him, not just, I think people probably quite like him, they haven't found anything much to dislike in him yet, but they can just see him as somebody of a bit more substance than they do at the moment.
So, Jenny, Lance thinks that David Cameron's a bit too cheesy.
Well, I think the polls show that that's actually not what the public think. And when you watch when you watch Cameron facing Brown in the Commons, then it's very obvious that although he is treating Brown with contempt, he's doing so in a very jaunty manner. It's attractive. He's not bitter. He's not being nasty. He's just so much in control of the situation. And Brown is almost helpless in his responses. He's only got one line, really, to come back to Cameron with, and it's, "You're a slick salesman." Now, it's really not good enough, because whatever Cameron's selling, he's selling it very well. And I think what's interesting is that, like Martin, I've always also been to several of these events with Cameron. And what's very striking is how thoughtful and measured he is. But I think he's probably calculated at this point is that you don't want to come out with too many complex messages. At the moment, you're still trying to build the image of who you are as a person. And second, if you come up with anything too concrete, as we've seen over and over again with everything from inheritance tax to taxing non-doms to flexible working, the Labour Party will just steal it. So it's really a no-win game for the Conservatives to stop being too detailed at the moment.
Well, all eyes are now fixed on next Thursday's Crewe and Nantwich by-election. Labour should hold the seat because it is defending a 7,000 majority. But Tory spirits are high, even though their candidate, Edward Timpson, is being lampooned as a toff. Our reporter Stephen Morris has been on toff duties in Crewe. We'll speak to him in a minute, but first let's hear him as he joined a celebrity tea party there.
Coronation Street in Crewe. Labour is holding a party in the front garden of a semi-detached house. The star guest is Liz Dawn. She's better known as Vera Duckworth from the fictional Coronation Street, the long-running soap. She's a long-term Labour supporter.
Thank you.
This is your house where the party is today, Alan.
It is, yes.
You're a Labour supporter, clearly.
I certainly am, yes. Yep.
So how do you think Labour's doing at the moment?
Well, I don't think they're doing very well, but with a lot of support, I think they'll be OK. I think they'll do very well, actually. Because they've always pulled themselves out in the end, haven't they?
What do you think of the developments yesterday, the 10p tax rate?
Oh, I don't like it, because I got made redundant after 28 years, and I've had to take a basic wage pay in a new job, and it's made me a bit worse off. Oh, I have to dip into food money all the time now, even though I've still got to pay full council tax and rent and everything. Petrol's going up, fuel's going up, everything's going up, but I haven't got a wage rise to cover it. So, struggling.
So what do you think about what happened yesterday? Are you happy with those developments?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's all right, that is, yeah. I'm quite happy. Yeah, it's fine.
Sandra and Jim Evans, what do you think of the visit today?
I thought it's gone off very well, and Liz Dawn, Vera, as we all know her, was great. She seems down to earth, a very nice lady.
And what about the candidate?
Oh, yeah, Sam Tamsin, yeah. She seems very nice, as if, you know, she's eager to get things done, hopefully, and sorted.
And Labour's having a few problems at the moment. What do you make of that?
It will be sorted out. There's no two ways. Gordon Brown will sort it out. Give the man time.
So, Steve, you've been moving amongst the stars in Crewe and Nantwich. Can you just tell us what on earth is the Labour Party up to, dressing people up in morning suits to mock the Tory candidate as a toff?
for some people that's quite a desperate measure, an indication that they really are struggling in this area. They're accusing the Tory candidate Edward Simpson of being posh, to put it quite bluntly. He's a Cheshire gentleman. He's from a wealthy family. He lives about 10 miles up the road from here, up in near Chester. And they're saying he didn't know what's going on amongst the ordinary people of Crewe and Nantwich.
And can I just ask you, that party that you went to that we heard the clip from, obviously there was a bit of discussion of the 10p tax there, the muck-up, and now the U-turn. Do you think that the announcement by the government is getting through to people on the ground?
I think it is to some extent, at least amongst those who are willing to be turned back towards Labour. I think people, and there are a lot of very traditional Labour supporters here, I think they've been looking for things that will steer them back towards the party they've always voted for. Amongst those who aren't so sure that the waivers, and I've come across many of those, I'm not sure it's made a great deal of difference. It's made the government just look a bit more like they're not quite sure which way they're going at the moment.
Great. Well, thanks for that. And next time, obviously, if you could bring us all Vera Duckworth's autograph, we'd be very grateful.
I'll do my very best.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Lance, can I just ask you, the fact that Labour, their key message of this by-election campaign is that the Tory candidate is, in their words, excessively posh, that's pretty desperate, isn't it? That shows that Labour's got nothing to say.
It's very depressing, to be quite honest. I mean, by-elections are often rather dirty affairs, and they often concentrate on issues that seem to be a bit wide of the mark in terms of what the challenges are for the government nationally. But, I mean, I don't think Labour stand a prayer in this by-election, and I suppose if the tactics succeeded, then people would look back on it and say, oh, well, you know, that was the turning point in Labour's recovery and in Gordon Brown's recovery. But if Labour do lose, I think a lot of people are going to have a very nasty taste in their mouth as a result of it all.
Jenny?
I hope there's a very nasty taste left in everyone's mouth, no matter what the result is. I think what Labour's doing there is absolutely indefensible. They should be fighting this on ideas, not on how much money candidates have. The other thing that's really noticeable is that Edward Timpson comes from a family which fostered more than 80 deprived children. You can't turn around and say this is a man who lives in a bubble. They're going for the nastiest and most simplest kind of class warfare politics, and they should be ashamed of it. They'd never have done it under Tony Blair, not least because Tony Blair was a public schoolboy.
Marty, can I ask you, this is a key moment for both the main parties, isn't it? If Labour loses, clearly that would be bad. But equally, if the Conservatives don't win, we would say to them, you're not where Tony Blair was just before that big landslide in 97.
Oh, absolutely. I think the expectations game around Crewe probably deserves a bit more careful thought because, you know, the Tories haven't won captured a by-election since 1982, which is 26 years ago, and even that was a slightly odd one. They haven't won one direct from Labour for 30 years. Now, if they are to do this, if you actually look at the where they're starting from, the first thing they had to do was make it absolutely clear to anti-Labour voters that they should rally behind the Tories. That was not, you know, normally over the last 20 or 30 years, you'd say that the Liberal Democrat candidate was going to do that. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the Crewe and Nantwich by-election is actually the Lib Dems have had so little traction. And I think that must be very troubling and concerning for their leader, Nick Clegg. The Tories clearly are now the favourites to win, and the expectations have risen enormously. But as you rightly say, Nick, anything other than a Tory win would be seen as a significant success for Gordon Brown and a troubling message for David Cameron. So it's a very high stakes day next Thursday for both party leaders and for both parties, and as I say, also for the Lib Dems.
Okay, thanks for that.
I'll sing you a song of John Prescott MP.
With a way, hey, blow the man down.
He's quick with his fists and he loves luxury.
Give me some time to blow the man down. He's
sharp. That was The Guardian's take on John Prescott when he stood down as Deputy Prime Minister last year. Yes, we thought we'd seen the back of the old bruiser, but he's back. He's publishing his memoirs with vivid accounts of the bust-ups between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Cherie Blair has joined in the fun too with her memoirs. The former Prime Minister's wife accused Gordon Brown of rattling the keys of Number 10 over her husband's head. And not to be left out, Tony Blair's former fundraiser, Lord Levy, has published his memoirs. Lance, you wrote your own memoirs, a bestseller I seem to remember. Do you recognise the Blair Brown rows we're being told about now?
Yes, and I remember them being a lot more intense than even these books are suggesting. I mean, I think both John Prescott, who's not famous for pulling his punches, and Cherie Blair have actually, for probably good political reasons, have decided not to go over the top and not to express quite how bad things were at times. And I think actually Gordon Brown might be looking at all this and thinking, I got off pretty lightly. And part of me thinks that actually it might be better for Gordon Brown if they had come out with all guns blazing, because that might have engendered a little bit of sympathy for him. People might have said, oh, he can't be as bad as all that. Whereas now they're thinking, oh, well, this just confirms what we've always thought about what the relationship was like. But we haven't actually heard anything very new from any of these books in terms of the relationship between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, certainly.
So if we were to have a truthful account, what would it be? Slamming doors, screaming matches?
Well, there was a bit of all that. Actually, slamming doors and screaming matches are probably easier to deal with than the way in which Gordon Brown used to behave in meetings that I was at, where he would just sit there and scowl and refuse to say anything. At least if someone's screaming at you, you can scream back. But if they're refusing to communicate, that could make life a little bit difficult, as we all know, in more personal circumstances. So, I mean, it's a matter of fact, of history, that it was a very, very difficult relationship. However, you know, they kept the show on the road, and despite John Prescott's suggestions, Tony Blair never sacked Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown never resigned, and Gordon Brown got what he wanted out of it. I mean, he was in for the long haul. He wanted to keep his powder dry as best he could, and he wanted to make sure that when the time for the succession came, he was the only realistic candidate. And many people would have said at the beginning of had they known it was going to take 10 or 11 years, that was a pretty difficult, if not impossible, thing to do. And he did it.
Now, Martin, you have an important place in all this, because I think I'm right in saying that you coined the phrase the TBGBs to discuss the bust-ups. Tell me, do you think that these memoirs are significant in the sense that they are the first official confirmation of the TBGBs?
Well, as Lance says, I mean, they are very restrained, and an awful lot of the TBGB culture is missing from these accounts, as it was also from Alistair Campbell's diaries, for the same reason. So I think, you know, as a historical record, I think these books are only are handled with care, because they're not the full story. I mean, the TBGB, the Gordon Brown Tony Blair battle, is a absolutely fundamental aspect of the whole period from 1994 to 2007, and to some extent it still is. I mean, these are three books, I think, by people who think that for one reason or another, their story hasn't been very sympathetically told. And also, interestingly, I think three people from, you know, pretty deprived backgrounds who have made it in the world in one way or another. And actually, you know, I've started to read Michael Levy's book. I possess a copy of Cherie Blair's book, but I haven't hardly opened it yet. Haven't seen John Prescott's book. But I think that is a common factor to them, that they're all quite interesting personal stories of a meritocratic kind of one sort and another. Whether they're going to do a whole heap of damage to Gordon Brown, I slightly doubt. I think, you know, the press at any rate this week has been brutal against all the authors, and particularly against Cherie Blair. You know, she doesn't like them; they don't like her, and it's ferrets in a sack at the moment. But actually, I think the books are probably worth reading.
Jenny, Martin is saying that the press has been brutal against these authors, and particularly Cherie Blair, but isn't one of the criticisms of these books, and particularly hers, is that they portray Westminster as a soap opera? And there's that story in Cherie Blair's book, isn't there, that Leo Blair was conceived at Balmoral because she forgot to pack her contraceptive kit, because the year before she'd gone there and her battered toilet bag was unpacked and the unmentionables were laid out in the bathroom. Do we need to know all that?
Well, I think where Sherry Blair and indeed John Prescott are mistaken is that you say, does it make Westminster look like a soap opera? I think they've seen that you can win great popularity if you're a soap star or a glamour model or a footballer by telling everybody about your deprived life and explaining why you've done what you did. But, of course, the public doesn't look at people like Prescott and Sherry Blair in that light. They've been very critical of them because they are in the political universe, and they expect them to behave with a great deal more dignity. And I think that the two of them have irretrievably damaged what are already pretty low public reputations by imagining that by telling us all this detail, we're somehow going to love and understand them. Instead, we think you had a completely different kind of role in our lives. You had a different image. You can't now come out and give us this kind of personal detail. And personally, as a professional woman, I find the idea that Cherie Blair, who's an amazingly intelligent QC, should be too embarrassed to take her contraceptives to stay with the Queen is absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, it's the kind of reaction you'd expect from a shy 15-year-old girl, and it makes her look ridiculous.
So, Lance, Cherie Blair is made to look ridiculous, but can I just ask you another element that comes out of those books is about your former boss, Alistair Campbell, that in there, Cherie Blair announces, tells Tony, her husband, Tony Blair, that she's pregnant. What's his first reaction? I must call Alistair. She announces that she's gone through the trauma of having a miscarriage. Tony Blair's reaction is, I must call Alistair because we're going to have to cancel our holiday to France in 2002 and the delayed holiday might look like we're about to invade Iraq. It's all a bit strange, isn't it? These great sort of personal moments. And Tony Blair says, I must call Alistair.
Yeah, I was quite shocked when I read that, actually. The second bit, anyway. I mean, the bit about Leo being conceived at Balmoral, I think we knew that. I deliberately left the full details of that out of my book because I thought it was a bit too personal. But I guess if I ever get the chance to do another edition, I can put it all back in again. My recollection, actually, is that of Tony Blair saying to me that he'd forgotten to pack the contraceptives. But anyway, I don't think we need to go there in any great detail. I actually felt, I mean, I like Cherie Blair a lot, and obviously I've been lucky enough to get closer to her than most people get the chance to do, and she's actually a very, very smart woman and a very appealing woman in many, many ways. And the story she told of her miscarriage and then while she was still in hospital having to have that awful conversation about what the political implications of them having to cancel a holiday might be, I mean, I really felt for her on that occasion.
Bit strange, isn't it? And there we were thinking that you had big policy discussions about the minimum wage with the Prime Minister, and in fact you were talking about his contraceptives.
Well, if you spend enough time with someone, you can talk about serious things and less serious things as well.
Well, on that note, thank you all very much. That's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, Tony Blair's former spin doctor Lance Price and The Guardian columnist Jenny Russell and Martin Kettle. Politics Weekly was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Till then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.